Welcome to the Jeff Knows Inc. Entrepreneurial Podcast with your host, Jeff Lopes. Jeff has over two decades experience as a serial entrepreneur, building brands like Kimuraware from his home basement to a multi-million dollar global brand that has sold over a quarter million pairs of boxing gloves. Jeff's here to educate, guide, and drive you on the process of bringing your ideas and dreams to reality with the inspiring stories from some of the top business minds.
Welcome to episode 147 of the Jeff Knows Inc. podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Lopes. Super excited to have on today Stan the Rhino Efferding. Great conversation, incredibly interesting individual, great story. Sit back, everyone, and enjoy. We're live on the Jeff Knows Inc. podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Lopes. Super excited to have on today Stan Efferding. What is up, brother?
Hey, how you doing, Jeff? Thanks for having me on, man.
This is going to be a fun, exciting conversation today. Stan is currently located in Las Vegas. Have you always been there?
Nope. Born and raised in Oregon, went to the University of Oregon, spent 20 years in Seattle, and that's what made me run to the sun.
Interesting. So growing up in Seattle, how many siblings did you have growing up?
I've got an older brother and an older sister. We're 1, 2, 3.
1, 2, 3. Growing up, was sports a big part of your... I just want to get into your journey of how you got into the fitness world and all that. Was sports, playing sports, a big part of your upbringing?
Always, yep. Since I was 5 or 6 years old, we played soccer, basketball, and football. I mean, you name it, tennis. It was always sports all year round. So it never stopped.
So when was the first time you picked up a weight and started your journey and falling in love with the sport?
You know, my pops brought home one of those Weider weight benches with the bar that would bend anything more than 100 pounds and those concrete-filled plastic.
Yeah. I still have those in my mom's basement. Yeah, they're gold with the red little clicks at the end.
Yeah, I was such a skinny kid. I wrestled 98 pounds as a freshman and sophomore in high school. I was 106 as a junior and 115 as a senior. So I was always scrawny kid. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But so I lifted a little bit of weights, but obviously I wasn't eating right. So I didn't get any results, but my pops always had me do a bunch of chin-ups and push-ups and sit-ups. So I always did good on the president's tests and all that kind of stuff. But you know, it wasn't until I got a college scholarship in soccer. I went to college and my coach thought I was undersized. He told me to go to the weight room and train that summer. And I actually trained at college with, an instructor in the anatomy department and phys ed who kind of showed me how to do it correctly. And that's when I really got hooked. And I actually went back 3 months later and told my coach I wasn't coming back to play soccer. I wanted to be a pro bodybuilder.
After 3 months?
I was 140 pounds. I told my coach I wanted to be a pro bodybuilder. I got hooked from that summer.
I love it. From there to your first show, what was the gap of time?
2 years later, I weighed 158 on stage in the novice lightweight class. I think I took like 12th or something like that. But I was hooked, man. Nothing could stop me. Nothing could deter me. Everybody told me I would never be big enough to be a bodybuilder. Certainly not a world record power lifter. But I just put my nose down and went after it. The more people that told me I couldn't, the more determined I became.
There's a big gap between the powerlifting world and the bodybuilding world. How did you combine those? Like when you were training, and do you find a lot of bodybuilders are really starting to lift a lot heavier and stuff like that, or are they more still focused on the bodybuilding world?
Well, they're focused on the bodybuilding world now in particular, because we've learned so much since I was coming up in the late 80s. I thought the stronger I got, the bigger I would get.
Yeah.
And we've since learned that that's not the case, that hypertrophy is different than strength. My strength training did not contribute to my bodybuilding. My bodybuilding, although contributed a lot to my powerlifting, because you get a great base, a GPP base of training everything from every direction. You have no weaknesses. You build a ton of cardio with all the volume and the sets and the frequency. So I was very, very, I think, well suited. It conditioned me well. So when I was powerlifting, I had fewer injuries. I recovered faster. I had fewer weak points. But it didn't work in reverse. And it wasn't until, I lifted heavy to try and get big for probably 12 or 13 years. And I got really, really strong that way. But I did not get a bodybuilder's physique that way. I got I got some decent size, of course, but it wasn't the kind of physique that would do well in bodybuilding. I competed all the way up to the Mr. USA and Junior USAs, but I couldn't crack the top five. And it wasn't until I trained with Flex Wheeler in 2009. He wouldn't let me squat, bench, or deadlift for 6 months and just put me on the kinds of bodybuilding movements in the 15 to 20 rep range, mostly doing pre-exhausts and single leg mind muscle connection stuff first. And then a lot of higher volume with, 2 minute rest periods. And we just did a lot of volume and frequency training twice a day, 6 days a week. And that made me finally fill out areas that I was unable to fill out, particularly my legs, because I was a big glute and back squatter. And so I would squat, 500, 600, 700 pounds and never had any legs to show for it.
Yeah. Flex Wheeler, that's the name of the man. He had a very, very prestige career, man. I remember growing up watching, reading those Flex magazines and all that, and always seeing Flex Wheeler on them and all that. And what a career he had. So going back now, from the time you did your first show till you went to your IFBB, get your IFBB pro card, what was the gap time wise?
First show was in 1988, and the pro card was 2009. Long, long time.
Yeah.
There was a period of about 8 years that I was working on starting and running my businesses that I did not compete. I took a little time off here and there, which turned out to be detrimental to my psychological and physical health in general, which I've talked about in my Stress for Success rant on YouTube. And then when I got back into competing back in 2006, and ultimately won my pro card in 2009, I had learned a lot of lessons along the way. I was training athletes and working with a lot of great bodybuilders and powerlifters and football players and track athletes. So I was a lot smarter, made a lot of mistakes, learned multiple times about how to bulk and how to diet without getting too fat or without losing too much muscle. And so when I finally applied that, when I had both the time and the money, and those are both very important things to in a sport, in any sport for that matter, I was just much better able to put everything into making better progress. I would say if I knew then what I know now, as we all do.
Yeah, 100%. So let's dive into that a bit. And I think that's an aspect of the bodybuilding world a lot of people don't see unless you're in it. And obviously you might not look at me now, but I mean, when I was 19, 20, I did three shows. I was really into that back in the day too. The psychological aspect of bodybuilding. And I went through it. I mean, it was just that constant battle. You're never happy. You're never sick. You have that almost that aiming at perfection you're never going to achieve. How give me a little rundown of the psyched aspect of bodybuilding. It has to be generally you. It could be just in general. How hard is it?
Well, I think it's actually one of the best things for any athlete to have that kind of drive, to never be satisfied.
Yeah.
What would the alternative be? I've achieved everything I want to achieve. I'm done.
Yeah.
I don't know a single high level professional athlete in any sport that's ever been satisfied from the time they started until even when their career is at its peak. So I think it's a good thing. Although you're right, it challenges you mentally. You're never ever satisfied. You never reach the point at which you're.
I get what you're saying there, and that's the way. Even as an entrepreneur, you're always achieving, which keeps you driving that hustle. So I get that aspect of it. I was talking more that underlining, like you and I've talked a lot of bodybuilders in the past where they go through that lumps of depression because it's just that constant battle, right, with themselves and never feeling satisfied with themselves. I do get both sides. I was just trying to understand more the tougher side of the bodybuilding world.
Yeah, that is challenging, especially, it's even worse now that you've got Instagram and social media because you're constantly comparing yourself to other people. And we do that, and did that, of course, back then as well, looking in the magazines or going to different gyms or even at competitions. And you're always looking at the next level or somebody that's better than you and you want to achieve that. Same thing in business. Somebody's got a bigger yacht or a bigger house.
Yeah.
Successful business. So but those are all carrots, I think, that just keep us driven, presuming that's, a goal that we're really intent on accomplishing. And For me, that was the single most important thing I ever wanted to do, was just to become a pro bodybuilder. And back then, there was only one choice, and that was bodybuilding. Now you've got men's figure,
physique,
men's
physique.
You've got the Mankini group with their board shorts.
Yeah.
Figured I'd throw that in there. I didn't have that choice. If I was a 158-pound guy and I knew I only had to get to 200 in order to possibly get a pro card in a men's physique class, it would have been a very different thing. But being 6 foot tall, I needed to be 240 plus of solid muscle.
What was your off weight season? Your off season weight when you got your peak?
Well, most of the beginning of my career, I wasn't any heavier. I was just struggling. I was a skinny kid. I was just struggling to add muscle. When I competed at 158, I don't think I ever got over 162 or something like that. And even when I won the Mr. Oregon so many years later in 2001, I think it was, or 1991, I'm sorry, 1991. Well, that's how old I am. Jesus, this has been a long journey. I probably only got as high as 205 and I competed at 201. So I've always had the opposite challenge. I struggled to hold on to weight. And so it was a constant battle just to eat enough food and not lose weight.
Yeah. Interesting. So you said you went through, this is an entrepreneurial podcast. Let's talk a little bit about that. You went through a gap where you didn't compete for a few years, starting a business. What were those companies you were starting up?
1995. I've always been entrepreneurial. I had a paper route when I was 8. I worked at a deli with my mom. And when I was 10, when I was 12, I worked at 7-Eleven for 4 years. Slung pizzas at a pizza place. And I got to college. I managed a little dumpy apartment community for free rent. I was painting units and collecting rent. And I was doing construction on evenings and weekends to pay for college, put my own self through college. So I had lots of jobs along the way. And then when I finally graduated from college, I worked as a maintenance man on an apartment community. Eventually worked myself up to manager and managed a 600-unit community and got recruited by a national REIT to run a 1,200-unit community that had their own phone and cable program. So I learned a lot about that. And so I had acquired, obviously, a lot of experience working, you know, whether it be customer service or just the knowledge of running large budgets and managing employees. I had 60 employees under me in Colorado when I was running that 1,200-unit community. And so I got hired to be a vice president of a telecommunications company with the experience that I learned from telecom and cable from running those large communities. And finally broke free after all those many years of helping other business owners become successful. I had a pretty good knowledge base. I think it's important that you kind of stay with something that you know or learn it first by working for someone who does.
Yeah.
And so I started a telecommunications company way back in 1990, I think it was 98. And I started a telecommunications company out of my apartment. I'd sold my home and cashed in my 401k, and I did a sweat equity deal buying a small apartment community, about 48 units with a partner. Yeah. And so I lived in it and I rented the units out and I mowed the lawns and painted the units and did all the sweat equity stuff. Hopefully that we could, you know, flip that apartment community. And that was kind of my first real investment on my own. And while I was in that apartment community, I used the knowledge that I had from being vice president of telecommunications company for someone else. And I started my own small telephone company. And we were running it out of that apartment, out of the manager's apartment. It was a little three bedroom. It was a dumpy little place in Lakewood, Washington, where they shoot, where they shot the Cops, you know, that television show.
Yeah.
It was. They actually came and shot Cops there. It's all the drug addicts and what have you. But it was a tiny little town outside of Tacoma, which is kind of a blue collar suburb of Seattle area. But, so I ran that apartment community and I started this little phone company, and we had three employees, friends of mine that I recruited from the telecommunications company I used to run. And we'd walk door to door and we'd knock on doors in low-income housing areas and get them to sign letters of authorization to let us take over and serve their telephone service. We would resell phone service from Quest, and we would buy the lines from them, and we would provide them to these low-income people who had been disconnected previously for running up long distance bills, et cetera. And I won't go too deep a dive into it, but nonetheless, 2 years later, we were in 22 states serving over 100,000 customers with over 100 employees, taking 5,000 calls a day and generating $25 million a year in gross revenue. So it was quite a journey to build that company up. And I used the revenue from that company.
And that was in a two-year period, you said?
Yeah, that was about a two-year
period. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah.
It was, that's very impressive, yeah.
Now, the first year was a struggle. I was eating at McDonald's.
Of course, yeah.
Everybody knows the, you know, the dollar meals and the, dinners with the, you know, mac and cheese and top ramen. I was broke. I mean, I was really broke. I had over $120,000 in credit card debt. I had a dozen credit cards that I had tapped out. And I was when they would send me checkbooks, I would write checks to my employees for payroll and then pay the other credit cards with the checks that the other credit card companies gave me. And I owed Quest about $250,000 at that time in phone lines that I had purchased and resold and hadn't been able to pay them back yet. So I had acquired quite a substantial amount of debt over the course of that first year, lost a lot of sleep, incurred a lot of stress. I had not worked out at a gym for over a year. Wow. Sleeping probably 4 hours a night, as a lot of people will tell you when they start a business. I experienced a lot of stress. And I went to the library one day, or the bookstore, I think it was Barnes and Noble, and I picked up a book called Stress for Success by Jim Lohr. And I still remember.
Yeah.
And I started reading it, and the whole book was about paying yourself first. It was about your health fundamentals: get adequate sleep, exercise regularly, and eat nutritious food. And that was really the message. And I still pound on that to this very day, how important it is. The number one thing you can do for stress and for success.
I do that too.
Pay yourself first.
And Oprah always says it, fill your cup first. You have to do everything.
Because we're burning the candle at both ends, and we completely disregard exercising, and we start eating, you know, fast food and quick crap. I was doing the same thing, and it really, really, I think, hurt my, you know, my ability to perform at work. And, you know, that's why some good employers will tell their best employees, they'll force them to take their vacations, and they become more productive, you know. So we used the revenue from that company. It was a significant amount of revenue, and I was paying, you know, usually 90 or 120 days in arrears to my vendors, Bell South, Quest, Verizon, you know, wherever I was in the country. So I basically had 120 days worth of income showing on my books. So we started buying apartment communities and building homes. I had a 40 lot subdivision of single family homes. We had multiple apartment communities. We bought some commercial real estate, doing what I had, you know, 10 years of experience in, which was operating multifamily properties and, you know, construction, because we had built a 150 unit property at one time that I was project manager on. So, and we did really well. That was right in the real estate boom. That was 2003 through 2007, 2008, right in there when the real estate market collapsed. We were, we probably had $70, $80 million worth of real estate at the time, with over $20 million in equity. And then the real estate market collapsed and it disappeared almost overnight. And the banks went from giving me, I was putting 1% down on a piece of land, and they were loaning me the entire construction cost on a home. I was putting, I think, 1-3% down on an apartment community that I was retrofitting into selling them as condos.
Times have changed, man.
Yeah, they were loaning me the construction.
Crazy.
And I was reselling the condos, obviously, at a profit. Well, then everything stopped overnight. I couldn't get loans. We had significant you know, assets still left. The real estate market, the value of the properties dropped. So the banks now wanted to get a 80% debt to equity on a property that had just depreciated 30 to 40%. So almost overnight, I'm selling my houses, I'm selling my cars, I'm selling all my toys. I had a $2.5 million home that I'd bought in cash. I had a couple other homes and $500,000 homes I'd purchased. You know, never lose money on real estate, right? No. Just keep buying real estate.
And that's like reality when you're looking at a business. Like I have a portfolio of real estate, 9 properties, and that's the exact same thing. Your mindset is always never fear real estate, and reality. Yeah, right. crazy story. Yeah.
Lost $4 trillion in market value, and boom, I sunk with the rest of it. Now, I grew up modestly. My pops never made more than $50,000 a year. He was a government worker. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, did odd jobs. So, you know, I didn't really put my identity into these things that I owned. It was fun. A lot of them were investments in my mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, I saw stories of people jumping in front of trains and you know, divorces and all kinds of stuff were rampant during that time. And I always looked at business like monopoly. Yeah. And it always seemed like play to me. And if I owed somebody, they took a risk for their return. And in my mind, you know, I was making them money when I was making them money. And if I lose, they lose. And so, sorry, I lost you there.
No worries. Yeah.
And so, you know, I didn't worry about it. I just dusted myself off. I sold everything I had. We started another company, you know, from scratch. At the time, obviously the stock market had crashed.
Yeah.
We had a bunch of stocks as well that we had to sell at a big loss. But we just what we discovered at the time is that the federal government had put about $4 billion into retrofitting airports throughout the country as a result of 9/11. They had to redirect all the baggage handling up into a special TSA
baggage handling.
You know, they could look at what's in the packages. And that was miles and miles of stuff. And so we hired a couple of engineers and started bidding on those projects because that was the only place there was any money was with the government, the only place they had any money. Real estate was dead. Stock market was dead. So we hired a couple of engineers from India to do the CAD drawings and the as-builts. And we started just basically bidding on those jobs. And we picked up some subcontracting work for Boeing and Raytheon and Lockheed Martin and Simmons and did that for a while. And then the TSA hired us to do a bunch of their security stuff. We would hire military veterans who already had the security clearances.
Yeah,
and get them any additional paperwork they needed. And then we would send them to the TSA and we basically worked as a job placement group for them. And that company thrived pretty well for about the next 5 years until the TSA started hiring all our employees away from us. and so, you know, we've just managed, we've survived. I'm an entrepreneur. I find opportunities. And then more recently, of course, you know, just a few years ago, some of you folks may have seen me on Shark Tank. I invented a cooler and I partnered with Damon John and, we just,
I didn't know that. Okay. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, I've
been an entrepreneur for God, almost 26 years, right? I've been an entrepreneur since I was 19. I'm 44. So let's talk about that. When were you on the show?
It's been almost 4 years ago now, if I can recall it. As an entrepreneur, you know as well as I do that when you look back, you cannot keep track of the coins because I'm only talking about the successful ventures.
Yeah. Oh yeah, of course. The wins and losses. As long as you got more wins stacked up, you're okay. You just put those in a suitcase. I love that. Okay, you said a cooler. That's, man, one thing about you is I'm loving it, is your hustle. It's just like, let's go. Yeah. How'd you do a cooler? Where did that start off from?
You know, I'm a bodybuilder, power lifter. You're in the carrying around drinks and shakes
and water
and all this stuff. And so I just invented this cooler that had, you know, it was a gallon ice cooler that you could put shakes into and have the twist off. And it all went together kind of like a Russian egg that you would assemble. Next thing you know, you got two shakes and a powder compartment and an ice water cooler. And it was just an idea that I had. And so I reached out to a guy to do a little CAD drawing and I threw it at some people in China and they built it. And then I just kind of went about marketing it like most people do. And then one day it turned out that Shark Tank was doing live auditions here in Las Vegas. And I said, what the hell? And I went down there and I stood in line. And I went to the live audition and, you know, she told me that I could come back and do another audition. And that began what was a 4-month journey of almost a weekly presentation, a video, a phone conference, submitting financials and business plans, et cetera, to Shark Tank, until finally I kind of threw at them some of my stuff from powerlifting and told them if any of this would be of interest. And they were like, "Oh, can you lift and on the show?" And so it kind of into a big, you know, I realized that the cooler wasn't going to be the driver.
Yeah.
I would have to sell the thing with, you know, a whole bunch of antics. And so sure enough, ultimately we coordinated with the producers to a script that involved some me lifting a big dumbbell and flipping a tire and deadlifting on the Shark Tank.
I gotta go back and try to find this episode now. This is awesome.
Oh yeah, Stan Efferding, Shark Tank on YouTube. They've been showing because it's such an entertaining, original kind of unique pitch.
Yeah.
They've been showing it to lead off every season for four years.
I love it.
Probably played 50 times in since the original.
I'm gonna ask you a question.
Yeah.
What do you think the value, and we'll talk about what the business did after, but what do you think the value of your time on that TV, if you were to put a dollar cents as a marketing value, what do you think is worth?
Well over $1 million.
Exactly. People don't have a clue. I was gonna say 1.5 at least. Like, people don't have a clue how much value that is. I just had a Richard, you know, Richard Rawlings, Gas Monkey Garage. I had him on a couple of weeks ago when we had a really, really great conversation. And he was talking about Fast and Loud, his whole show. And the first like six seasons, the History Channel is like, do whatever you want. And he was coming up with tequila companies, energy drinks, and advertising and all. And then eventually they're like, oh, you can't do that anymore. You can't do this anymore. And then he's like, forget this. And he was like, every time I would do an episode, that was like a $3-4 million. This is a full hour episode. It's like a $3-4 million advertising on that product. It was just crazy. People don't realize the value of getting on. And even for yourself, the self-branding, the everything is huge, huge.
Yeah.
So,
I've been in the magazines, you know, I've been featured in Muscle and Fitness, and Flex magazine sponsored me, and on the cover of Power magazine twice. And none of that, all of that together didn't provide me the same kind of marketing as one episode, which was originally one episode. It hit 10 million homes.
It's crazy. You know?
And overnight, I sold more coolers in 3 months than I'd sold in the previous 3 years.
So what was your sale those 3 months, give or take, a rough estimate of gross?
I probably did over $500,000 in 3 months on coolers, but I had done maybe 100,000 in the 3 years prior.
That's crazy. A lot of people say logistically, once you get off, they say, I was reading some stat, they say roughly 60 to 70% of deals that are done on the show never manifest after, because the logistically or the deals don't happen, or you find the sharks a little too greedy. Because I was just talking to a few months back to Chris Gronkowski, and the way he got on the show for his shaker was he had to bring all his brothers on. So he had to bring obviously the star on to get on. That was the deal. If you bring all your brothers on, we'll get you on front of the camera. So, and he ended up doing a deal with, I think, Damon and oh my God, my head just drew a blank right now. God, the Dallas Mavericks owner.
Yeah, you know what? I'm forgetting too.
Yeah. But long stories, he made the deal, and he said it was like it was such a struggle to finish that deal. It was so, they wanted A, B, C, D. So was it hard to finish the deal with Damon?
Yeah, I did a 20-minute video, another rant on YouTube. I have these rhinos rants, and I talk about a lot of this stuff. I mentioned,
oh, you do? Okay, cool.
I mentioned why I'm a hypocrite and behind the scenes at Shark Tank, and I went through some of this. And it was, when you make a deal, well, here's the thing, over 30,000 people applied for the show.
Yeah.
120 present to the sharks, and about 80 of them will actually get on TV. Yeah. And only about half of those will ultimately end up inking a deal with the shark. Yeah. So it's really, the odds are long and hard. The reason is that the verbal deal that you make with the shark, sorry, got you back. The verbal deal you make with the shark, you have to then actually, you know, finalize that contract with the shark.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And I was midway into a conversation with Damon John after we had verbally agreed on the Shark Tank.
Yeah.
Well, the sharks have a huge influence over which episodes air because the companies that they invest in, they obviously want on TV.
Yeah.
And I don't know to what degree, but Damon made it clear, look, you know, if we don't have a deal, the likelihood of you getting on the show is pretty slim because we want our deals to be aired. That's the marketing. That's their entire foundation of their investment in the business is to get to those 10 million homes to kick this thing off in most cases. And I realized very shortly into the conversation with Damon and his team that I was once again applying for a job. And so I had to start selling myself to Damon on a phone call after I'd already presented on Shark Tank and struck a deal.
Yeah.
and indeed I did. I told him about, you know, some of the things I was working on, and, you know, I had obviously by then I'd started a very successful meal prep company. I had a very successful international ebook franchise with the Vertical Diet, and I had been traveling and doing seminars and training some of the greatest athletes in the world. And I started dropping names, of course, Hafþór Bjornsson and Lane Johnson from the Philadelphia Eagles, and Brian Shaw, four-time World's Strongest Man, and the list goes on and on. Now John Jones, I'm training for his heavyweight debut in the UFC. So, you know, it as you know, in this business, it's constantly marketing.
Yeah.
And you know, building the confidence of those people who are investing in you or you know, partnering with you, it seems like you're constantly having to prove and resell yourself, no matter every step of the way.
So the deal is, you still have this company?
Yes, I still have the company.
And you're still in partners with Damon?
We're partners with Damon. Okay. Now with COVID and the shipping issues, you know, shipping rates skyrocketed, tariffs with the obviously the Trump's trade war, which I'm all for, by the way. I was fine with that. It's the same for everyone, but the cost of goods skyrocketed, and so I had to pause. Had to pause for a while, but I still have you know, that product. I'm distributing it through my meal prep company, and so. But it was an interesting venture. It didn't. The problem with goods, as you know, are you have to prepay for them, wait for them to get shipped here, warehouse them, then sell them to a wholesaler who then sells them to a retailer who then sells them to the consumer. Your margins on those things are very, very slim. I'm lucky to make a couple of bucks off of a cooler. That's why I like services. That's why I like selling information. That's kind of where I'm at now. Because your cost of goods are zero once your brainchild has been born.
Built,
And so I sell information mostly now with the Vertical Diet Plan. The meal prep company does a little better, but the great thing about the meal prep company is compared to selling a widget or a t-shirt or a cooler is that it's a recurring sale.
A membership base?
It is, but just the idea of people, you have to eat four meals a day every day. And that's why, you know, you can have those people setting up at Costco giving you samples, because once you start buying their product, you generally keep buying their product. So you're obviously your advertising cost per customer may be high initially, but over time, I'm always cautious when I talk to people about trading time for money or making money while you sleep.
Passive income.
Passive income, the massage therapist, the personal trainer, which I was for 30 years. I still do some. You're trading time for money. And that's, never make
it. You're essentially self-employed, not an entrepreneur. You're self-employed at that moment.
100%. So I like the kind of thing, the recurring sale kind of thing, where you wake up in the morning and, oh, look, somebody went to my store and purchased.
It's a good feeling. Yeah, I know. I hear you. It's funny because you're saying the whole thing about manufacturing goods. A company that I've had for 15 and a half years called Kimura, where we manufacture boxing and martial art equipment. And we've been, and we deal with about 1800 gyms, which we do the wholesale. So I'm the, we design, manufacture. So I understand the whole pain of importing. I buy all my raw materials. We import them. So the last, 17 months, the cost of raw materials has skyrocketed. The cost of logistics has skyrocketed. The wait times, we have containers sitting at the port in Canada for 2 months, 3 months. And every time a Walmart container comes along, they say, oh, Jeff's container, don't worry, it's not important. And it keeps getting bumped back and bumped back. So I understand that pain right now. We're going through it right now. So I understand that aspect of that business. So the vertical diet, when did that all start? Actually, before we get into that, I want to ask you a question I had in my head before I forget. Rhino, where'd you get that nickname? Who gave that to you?
Flex Wheeler, 2009. I love it. So he threw that at me.
Love it. Love it. Love it. Okay. Vertical diet. When'd you start that exactly? And did it start off as a meal prep or started off as a book? Like what was the initial aspect of that?
You know, the vertical diet is more than just a diet. It's kind of the culmination of everything that I've learned. And I talked through my history of competing, bulking up and dieting down for all those years. I probably gained and lost well over 1,000 pounds throughout my career.
Yeah. Easy.
Damn near 300 to power lift and then dieting down to, you know, 4% body fat. And so I learned a lot of lessons along the way. I obviously got a science degree from the University of Oregon where I studied psychology and exercise science. I was a personal trainer, high school soccer coach, trained football players and track athletes at the University of Oregon. I've owned two different gyms, just been a trainer all my life. And I've obviously competed and then started working with a lot of great athletes and collaborated with a lot of smart people, you know, a lot of great coaches. And so I was repeating myself to every single client. And so I put everything in one document. And interestingly enough, I put it on the notepad in my iPhone so I could copy and paste it, you know, for efficiency. Somebody asked me about sleep, boom, copy, paste. Somebody asked me about, you know, hydration, boom, nutrition, digestion, blood testing, you know, you name it. And that's what the vertical diet is. So eventually I compiled all of those copy and paste notes that I was providing for my clients into one large document right from the notepad. And I named it the vertical diet. And because it's a foundation, you can't put a 3-bedroom house on a 2-bedroom foundation. So I called it the vertical diet because you build this foundation first and foremost of all those lifestyle habits and the nutrition that's necessary, you know, in terms of macros and micronutrients to be able to then build the vertical, the skyscraper. You can put a Hofthor Bjornsson on that, a 400-pound athlete, or you can put, you know, a CrossFit national champion, you know, whatever. And then eventually dad bods and soccer moms needed the same foundation of sleep, hydration, nutrition, digestion, all those things. And so even with my, you know, my regular folks, I would send them this document and make just a few adjustments for their personal needs based on their BMR, you know, and their work rate and maybe some health issues that they would specifically experience. And then I went up to Iceland when I was working with Hofthor Bjornsson. He's Mountain from Game of Thrones.
Everybody knows him. Yeah. trying to be a boxer now.
Yeah. And I did a seminar up there for a group of competitive athletes, powerlifters, bodybuilders, strongmen and the like. And it was a 2-hour seminar and the guys videotaped it and posted it on YouTube. And it's now got almost 7 million views.
Wow. And that's not easy for YouTube.
No. And really from that foundation, from naming it, from branding it, so it's not just Stan Efferding's diet, to marketing it, then I sold that ebook. I put it on my site as the Vertical Diet ebook, and it sold internationally. And it was a huge, huge hit. And then what I did is I updated it. I went to a vertical diet 2.0. As I started to get feedback from customers all over the world, I answered at least in the first 2 years, I answered over 50,000 DMs from people asking questions and comments and what have you. And I used that information, a lot of them were the same questions, to expand and update the document based on the feedback I was getting and the results that those people were getting and informing me of. And then eventually the vertical diet 3.0. And I provided those for free to any previous purchaser. So it became more of a living document, a membership of sorts.
Yeah.
More recently.
It's like a community in a way, right? You're constantly feeding them.
It is. Yeah. Then I partnered with a registered dietitian PhD who was head of the dietetic department at UNLV.
Yeah.
And we compiled over 500 scientific references, to support every aspect of the diet and to refine the message and make sure it appealed to a broader audience and it met, I think, what would be acceptable criterion for the recommendation made. I never wanted to be a biohacker or something like that. I wanted to give people real solid down-to-earth information. And then we released a book, Victory Belt, just published The Vertical Diet book. It's in Barnes and Noble. It's the number one new release on Amazon for 3 weeks running now. And that's available worldwide. I have people from, you know, Germany and the UK and Australia and all over the US ordering the book from me now. And that's kind of the latest version. Although we'll continue to update the.
I was going to say, this constantly going to be growing. I love that.
Yeah. And a couple of years, well, 3 years ago, because obviously food's the foundation, I had a lot of people solicit me over the years to start a supplement company. And I've really never been a supplement consumer. Matter of fact, I have a quote that's popular in the industry called "Shakes are for fakes, eat steaks." And that's, okay. I've never been a big shake. I've always been a food guy, food first. And that's not to say there isn't a place for shakes here and there. And we use a hydration protocol before, during, and after training to help athletes, particularly those that sweat a lot or have two-a-day trainings. But so I got a call from a partner, a PhD powerlifter, he's got a PhD in biology, I believe. And he said, "Hey, you want to start a meal prep company?" And I was like, I'm all over it. I got on an airplane. I flew out to see him the very next day with a wad of cash. And I said, let's get this going. I'm not fucking around. And he had partnered with a meal prep company that had been in business for 20 years. And so we immediately had national distribution.
Yeah, which is massive.
Yep. I brought him my meals and told him where to source the foods from and how to make them. They made them. I loved the taste of them. They started manufacturing. We were in business within 90 days and we were nationwide serving meal prep company. And we did $3 million in gross sales last year in meals nationwide.
Yeah. Very good, man. Good for you, brother. I love the hustle, man. I mean, you don't know me. So I'm 24/7 go, whether it's, I'm always trying to do something new business-wise, entrepreneur-wise. So I love, like, to me, when I see people like you and what you're achieving and how you're always pivoting. I mean, I love it. I absolutely love it. So congrats on all that, man. What does fatherhood mean to you? I'm going to throw a little curveball to you.
Oh man. I've said this before and I keep saying it. When my children were born, I finally realized I'm not the most important person in the world.
It happens automatically, huh? Like, you don't even think about yourself. I was talking about something about this the other day. It's like wintertime comes along. You're not being like, okay, I got to go here. No, it's like, okay, do you have a jacket? Do you have your boots on? Everything changes. You don't even think of yourself anymore. Everything yeah. Alters and changes. I love that. Go continue. Sorry.
Competing in bodybuilding and powerlifting or any sport and even business.
Yeah.
It's such a selfish endeavor. I mean, it's a 24/7 and it's all about you and what your goals are. When my kids were born, that changed. I found it benefited me because the entire foundation of my success with the Vertical Diet came from giving, helping others, giving information to other people. Yeah. All the seminars, the free content that I put out on YouTube for a number of years. I've had about 5 requests for refunds out of the thousands and thousands of eBooks that I sold. One of them was a lady who said there was no grocery shopping list. So I added a grocery shopping list. One of them was a lady who said that somebody had pirated it from the internet and gave her a free copy. So she wanted a refund from me. But one of them was a guy who said, "Stan, there's nothing in this book that I haven't already learned from watching all of your free content." And I thought that was wonderful. I
love it. Great.
And if you're inclined to watch 30 or 40 hours worth of, you know, news and podcasts and rants, then that's fine. But if you want it all in one easy to follow step-by-step guide that you can reference to, but that was kind of the foundation of the success of the Vertical Diet. I remember my wife saying to me when they posted that 2-hour Iceland video, she's like, "Nobody's going to buy your ebook. You just put the whole thing out on the internet." And just the opposite happened. Thousands of orders poured in. I know when I watch a podcast that at the end of that podcast, if I didn't have a piece of paper and wasn't taking notes, I forgot 90% of it already. And I got to go back and watch it again. I do this all the time. I get so mad at myself when I watch a good podcast and I didn't take notes. Yeah. And so that I'm like a lot of people. Plus, I like to have I like to hold on to something. I like to have a hard copy.
I'm the same. I like the physical. I like grabbing a highlighter and highlighting. The other day I went to the beach with the kids and I have my book and when I pull out a highlighter, I'm always like, well, he brought a highlighter to the beach. And I'm like reading, I'm highlighting. So you go back and find spots in the book that you remember, right?
100%. I've got a ton of books downstairs and I don't reread them. I go through and I read the highlights.
Yeah, exactly.
And I love it. Find what my book is like. My book gives you the big rocks.
Yeah.
And then I put links to articles and videos that allow you to take a deeper dive.
Yeah.
So, because sometimes when I buy a book, like most people, when they buy a book, a diet book, some books, especially if they're academic books, and I partnered with an academic to make sure that this was comprehensive. There are books about dieting.
Yeah.
It's not a specific diet plan. And people get frustrated that they're going to have to spend hours and hours and hours and hours reading through this thing.
And then doing it themselves after.
I'm a checklist guy.
Yeah.
You know, I need pictures. I need here's the top 10 things that you do. I have a high blood pressure quick fix kit. I have my high blood sugar quick fix kit. Yeah. I have my acid reflux guidelines, and it's bam, bam, bam in a hierarchy of order of importance. Here's what you need to do. Let's go. And I have my checklist. Here's your daily checklist. You need to take a 10-minute walk after meals. You got to weigh yourself. You got to get your 7+ hours of sleep. Here's your supplements that you take. I have a checklist. I haven't competed in 7 years, but I print out a little sheet and I put the days of the month across the top. And on the left-hand side, I have a list of things that I need to check off every day, whether it's taking your vitamin D or if you have any medications or if you need your workout or, again, your 10-minute walk, how many hours of sleep, what you weigh. I track those things every day so I can just glance at the sheet. And it's painfully obvious whether or not I'm doing my part.
Yeah.
And if I'm not succeeding in the manner in which I expect, I can just look at it and say, oh, there you go. There was 5 hours of sleep. There was 5 hours of sleep. Oh, there I missed a workout. Oh, I only got 3 meals that day. I needed 4, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So it holds you accountable. Accountability is key.
It does. And I trademark the term, as you know, when we come up with these terms, we think we're geniuses. So we trademark everything. I trademarked the Monster Mash. That's my meal. That's my foundational meal. I mix ground bison with a couple of scrambled eggs and a little bit of white rice and some bone broth into a mash. And it's the most popular meal I sell. I sold over $1 million of Monster Mash last year.
I love it.
I named my meal.
But I love it.
One of the terms that I trademarked was compliance is the science. And the foundation of my entire diet program is how can I help people make this a lifestyle? Simple, sensible, and sustainable, because all diets work when they're strictly adhered to.
Yeah.
And the best diet is the one you'll follow. And so a lot of my book is about teaching people how to comply, little tips and tricks here and there to make it easier on them to, whether it's meal prepping or using a thermos when you travel, so you've got hot meals and you don't have to get stuck at the airport or a hotel. Just compliance methods is really kind of the foundation of the whole program. It's making it easy to do.
Love it. I love it. I'm going to ask you 2 more questions. Sure. Your wife, how long have you been married and what does she mean to you?
Oh, I met my wife 20 years ago. She was born and raised in Western Samoa.
Okay.
And then moved to American Samoa when she was 7 years old. And I have a rant, an obesity rant, where I talk about how she was raised
I'm going to go buy your watch all your rants now. I'm dying to see these.
The 4-post hut with a grass thatched roof, blankets for windows. It was a dirt floor. They'd roll out reed mats. Had 12 brothers and sisters.
Wow!
They would grow all their own food: pigs, raise chickens, taro root. Go to the ocean, obviously in Samoa, and collect whatever they could off the ocean floor, and take it to the market and sell it in order to be able to buy things. But they were very healthy when they lived in Western Samoa.
Yeah.
No obesity in the family. Then they moved to American Samoa and they had food stamps in American Samoa. So nobody grew their own food. The marketplace wasn't very vibrant. They all bought seed oils, white flour, and sugar because that was the cheapest stuff to bring to the island.
Yeah.
And all the families started suffering from obesity. It's an epidemic in Samoa now. And her pops ultimately passed away at an early age from complications from diabetes. So Just a little background history, but she, when she was 26 years old, she moved to Seattle. She got on a plane, first time she'd ever left the island. She moved to Seattle. And on the island, there's only one stop sign, no stoplights. It's 25 miles an hour speed limit on the whole island. She rented a car when she landed in Seattle and got out onto the I-5 freeway. Everybody's racing by at 70 plus miles an hour. You know, it's 5-6 lanes wide. It was, she said she was literally crying, driving, just frantic, you know, like 50 miles an hour down the freeway. She picked up a one of those little, what was it? We used to run employment ads in one of those little nickel ads.
Yeah.
That's when I was vice president of a telecommunications company up there, and we were hiring call center employees. She applied for the job. She came in to apply for the job in this long flowery dress, like you'd see, you know, on a Pacific Islander with a flower in her ear. Most beautiful woman I had ever seen. And I was the creepy boss. I was the hashtag guy. But this was 20 years ago. And so, you know, there was no Me Too movement.
I was going to say that shit wouldn't last right now.
I hired her on the spot. I was like, can you type? No experience. So you're not. And it was a couple years before I just couldn't take it anymore. And I asked her out. Maybe a year, maybe 9 months. I don't know. sure enough, we've been together ever since. And question two is, what does she mean to me? I believe she's unbelievably smart. None of my businesses would be successful without her. And I've read The Millionaire Next Door many, many years ago, where, you know, 95% or 97% of those millionaires have, you know, a long-term wife. That has been kind of the foundation for them. And she really has been that for me. She's been my rock. And behind the scenes, she helped start that telecommunications company that I, you know, started and has helped me run all of my businesses.
I love it.
Recently, and I have to say this is amazing. She has always been into clothing. She worked on the island for a clothing manufacturer, always been into clothing.
Yeah.
Started her own clothing line about 2 years ago, and she kind of, you know, she'd get an order here and an order there, and it was kind of a neat little thing that she did at home. I call them like boutique businesses.
Yeah.
It was costing me more than she was making.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
She was happy, happy wife, happy life.
Yeah.
But 6 months ago, she started doing Facebook Lives, and her Facebook was By Kehlani, K-Y-L-A-N-I, I believe. Oh my God.
It exploded. That's crazy. Yeah.
My entire house is now a business again. My dining room, my living room, my den. It's all just my garage, which has my gym in it, is stacked up with clothes and stuff. She sells, listen to this, she'll start a live at maybe 5 or 6 o'clock at night, sometimes go till midnight and sell $10,000 worth of clothing in one evening.
On the live. So she's doing almost like her own shopping network.
Home
crazy.
Shopping. It's crazy.
Oh, that's awesome. Amazing. That is awesome.
Beautiful back. Obviously she's just incredibly gorgeous, and she's, you know, Samoan. So she's obviously authentic, and she has a big Polynesian Pacific Islander audience. I go downstairs and the entire living room is covered with these little bags of things that people bought, and it has their name on it. And all the names have like 17 vowels and one consonant. And she has a very loyal
following. I love it.
And now she's in LA today shopping. She's going down through the district. She's ordering clothing from Bali that she had gotten. So she's shipping stuff in from China now and filling our stuff or from Bali. And she'll take the van and it's just packed full. She's like, honey, can the van hold 1200 pounds?
I love it.
So I don't mean to blather on and on.
No, I love it. It is so true. You said, I don't know how it is in the US, but in Canada, 62, 63% of entrepreneurs are divorced.
Yeah.
And I've been married. I'm going to 18 years. My wife is the pure opposite of me. I'm 24/7 go, 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 hustle, hustle, hustle. My wife's the grounded. My wife has a saying where if today didn't change, it was a good day. She's a very simple, down to earth. She's my anchor. I come home. She's my anchor. She's my reality check. She'll give me a slap and wake me up when I need to wake up. And it's crazy. She's very independent. She has a great career. She has her job. We've been married for 18 years, Dan. We don't have one bank account together. And we're happy. We never argue about money, and we have a great life. And you have to find your right person, right? And if you're lucky enough to find them, and you have to understand that you have to have that balance. I mean, I wrote a book, Entrepreneurial Dad: How to Find Balance Between Being an Entrepreneur and Being Number One Seller, being an entrepreneur, being a dad. You have to find it. And you always hear these massive entrepreneurs like Gary Vee saying there's no balance. There is a way to find a balance. There is a way to put in your non-negotiables into your schedule and be there. Like you said, took your kids to school. That's why you want to be an entrepreneur, to do those things. So if you're not doing those things, then what's the purpose? It's being able to put those non-negotiables in and build those memories that one day you're not here, your kids are going to have all these memories of their dad, and which is so special. So I love what you're doing, man. So that's very, very cool. That's going to lead me into my last question. And then we're going to jump off because I don't want to take any more of your time. If something were to happen to you today, in a few words, how would you want to be remembered or described by your loved ones?
Wow. I just think that by prioritizing them, I told a good friend of mine last summer, I bought an RV. I toured the entire United States. I did 60 cities in 60 days. I did seminars, all 48 states plus Washington, D.C. I just mapped out a path, bought an RV, and took off driving. I prearranged about 20 of the seminars. And then while I was on the road, I was closing locations throughout the country.
Pure hustle, huh? You're such a hustler.
Locked down for a year. And I've been over 200 seminars in 10 countries in all 50 states now.
Yeah.
And that was kind of my thing. Every weekend, I'd fly out on a Friday, come home on a Sunday, and I would go do seminars.
Yeah.
And then we were locked down because of COVID, and I couldn't do a seminar for a long, long time. And so it looked like COVID was lifting. I said, I'm going to do the whole, I'm just going to make up for all the lost time. I did this big 60 cities in 60 days, this epic tour. And a friend of mine, Bobby Summers, who was a military veteran, he was a Purple Heart that was injured in the Iraqi war.
Yeah.
He deals with PTSD and suicidal veterans. And so he joined me about four cities into the tour. He joined me for he wanted to present. And after presenting that evening for 10 minutes and seeing what we were doing, he said, "Hey, can I go on the rest of the trip with you?" So he jumped in the van and we toured the whole country. And, I just want for people, you know, you said, how would you want people to remember you? And I just that I have tried so hard to give information that's valuable, that'll help other people with physical or mental challenges or goals. And I get a lot of feedback from people all over the world all the time. Life changing is what people will say when they implement some of the tips, tricks, or techniques that I have learned from my experience. And so I think more than anything, I think most of the people that I come across, and I shook 4,000 hands on that trip, and people told me stories. Most of them had watched all my stuff and been there just to tell me kind of how they had been influenced by some of the stuff I had put out there, similar to what the kind of messages that you put out in your book, and just things that you learned. Just a simple little thing that someone reads, they're like, damn, that was really helpful.
Yeah.
More than anything, I would want for people to just remember in some way that they had learned something from some information that I was able to provide.
I love it. I love it. I love it. And all our show notes, I'm going to put all your links from your book to your diet plans to your meal plan company. I'm gonna put everything on there for all our guests to get a hold of you and follow you and all that stuff like that. And any last thing you want to leave with our guests today?
No, that's it, brother, man. We covered everything. This was really enjoyable. I'm usually asked about diet stuff exclusively, but I love to be able to share some of the adventures that you and I both
I loved it. This is when I go into a conversation, Stan, is I, and like I said, we've had massive guests on, massive guests. And I've had a few of them at the end where like, you didn't do any research on me. I'm like, I know. I love being curious. I love just learning it. Yeah. I love, like if you saw me, I had a smile the whole time when you're telling stories. Cause to me, that's what makes the whole podcasting show to me is why I do it. I want to learn. I want to network. I want to meet people. And it's crazy. Just, you never know. Like I could see you on Instagram. I would never even have a thought process of all these ventures and chart. Like the stuff you've done is incredible. So yeah. This has been a great conversation, man. I love it. Our audience is going to get a ton of the value out of this.
It's been an incredible journey. Like I said, most of it, I can't even remember until I start talking about it. What's amazing about what we do in our lives is that we have no idea what's next.
Yeah. I love it. I love it.
I was like, what's your why or whatever they asked me. I don't know. And I'm like, I don't even slow down long.
It's so crazy. Is I always said, and I've done successful, I've owned gyms, I've my background in college was fitness too, so I've been all these different routes, and I've had event company, I've done all this stuff, and I always looked at my wife and said, by 45 I want to semi-retire. And then COVID hit, Stan, and instead of relaxing, I revved up all my companies. I wrote a book, I started the podcast, I doubled everything, I did other investments, and I just went crazy. I was like, everybody's slowing down. Let's go. And it's been just like, and I love it. I don't think I'll ever be able to stop, because that's just our genetic, our DNA, whatever you want to call it. It's just that drive, right? I think we just, if you're stopped even for a day or two, if I go on vacation, after a day, I'm like bored. I got to be writing. I got to be thinking my next venture. So I everything you're saying, I love it. That's why I had a smaller face, because that's everything you're saying is me in a nutshell. So I love it. I love it. I love it.
Man, thank you so much, Jeff. I appreciate you having me on the show.
This is awesome, buddy. Thank you.
That's a wrap for today. I want to thank our guest, Stan, for being such an incredible guest. Great conversation, great stories, incredible entrepreneur. If you guys enjoy this podcast as much as I have, like always, please do us a favor. Tell your friends, tell your family, spread the word. We're trying to build something special here. Leave a review. 5 stars would be absolutely amazing. Like always, myself and my staff love spending time reading the reviews. Until next week, guys, keep moving forward.